Hello, lovely Buddhas. Continuing with Chapter 5, Pioneers of the New Human Revolution, Volume 1, we will be reading from pages 285 to 304 today. So let's begin. As Shinichi Yamamoto and the other leaders came into the airport's lobby, they were greeted by the unexpected strains of the Gakkai's Ifu Dodo no Uta. Coming after the group's anxious and somewhat forlorn journey, it filled their hearts with a sense of homecoming and courage. Between 20 and 30 people were lined up in the lobby. The members sang with all their hearts while gazing at a large lyric sheet attached to wooden dowels. As if they had only just learned the song and were not yet familiar with the words, their singing was out of rhythm and far from powerful. The well-wishers who had gathered to greet Shinichi and the others in North America had been mainly women, but here more than half were men. Many of them, having emigrated to Brazil from Japan, were farmers. These friends, their sunburnt faces shining brightly and tears flowing from their eyes, were singing this newly learned Soka Gakkai song with all their might. When Shinichi thought of the long hours the members had already waited for their arrival, he was filled with an overwhelming sense of affection and tenderness towards them. "Thank you," said Shinichi, when they had finished their chorus. "I apologize for being so late. You must have been waiting for hours." He then sat down on a nearby bench. The airport lobby was dimly lit, most of the lights having been turned off due to the late hour. Most of the men who had gathered wore suits and ties, but they seemed rather unaccustomed to such attire. The ties of some of them stuck out from under collars that were somewhat askew, while others wore their suit jackets with all of the buttons fastened. After the leaders accompanying Shinichi had introduced themselves, Shinichi rose to his feet to speak to the members. Out of consideration for the lateness of the hour, Shinichi kept his words brief, simply expressing his appreciation. "Thank you very much for coming to the airport to meet us. I am deeply grateful for your sincerity. Seeing that it's already very late, let's meet again tomorrow." Among the local members were a number of youth whom Shinichi had encouraged back in Japan. He now asked one of them, "How many hours did it take those living furthest away to get here?" "About 3 or 4 hours by bus," came the response. "What will they do tonight?" he asked. "It's been arranged that they stay with members who live in and around the city. We've also taken the liberty of booking a hotel for you and your party," the youth informed him. The party had already reserved their hotel accommodations, but when Shinichi heard of the local members' sincere gesture, he said, "That's very kind of you. Thank you very much. We'll stay at that hotel tonight, then." Shinichi did not wish in any way to reject the members' kind-hearted intention. He decided to spend at least one night at the hotel arranged for them by the members. Shinichi Yamamoto and the other leaders caught taxis to their hotel. Traveling quickly through the streets of Sao Paulo in the early hours of the morning, they finally arrived there around 3 a.m. The hotel was very modest and the rooms were small. When Shinichi got to his room, he gazed at his reflection in the mirror. His eyes looked hollow, shadowed by dark circles. "My goodness," he thought, afraid that the Brazilian members would worry if they saw him in this condition. Although they would be staying in Brazil for 3 nights, they actually only had 2 full days to conduct their activities. In his mind, Shinichi went over all that he must achieve during that time. The night wore on quietly. Outside, everything was shrouded in deep darkness. In Shinichi's heart, however, there burned the bright crimson flame of his fierce resolve to usher in the dawn of Brazilian Kokosanrufu. At 10 the following morning, Shinichi and his party split into 2 groups and set off on a tour of the city. Katsu Kiyohara Chūhei Yamadaira and Yukio Ishikawa visited the Tozan farm in Campinas, some 100 kilometers northwest of Sao Paulo. Shinichi Yamamoto, Kiyoshi Jujo and Aisuke Akizuki went to visit the Kotia Industrial Cooperative and other sites. The Kotia Industrial Cooperative was an association formed by Japanese immigrants in Kotia in the state of Sao Paulo. At the time, it was actively promoting emigration to Brazil among Japanese youth and making great contributions to the development of Brazilian agriculture. In the evening, Shinichi and the other leaders held a Gongyo meeting at a member's home in Sao Paulo. By the time Gongyo was completed, the room was filled beyond capacity with members. Shinichi asked each person about his or her work and daily life. Many had moved to Brazil as farmers after World War II. Their lives, however, were far from easy. One, who had worked as a farmer under a 4-year contract, related how he had been assigned to live in an old barn with neither electricity nor running water, and how snakes would crawl in during the night while he was asleep. If you had a bad harvest, he added, then debts were all you were left with. Another member, who had been a farmer in Japan, had sold all of his property to buy land in Sao Paulo, wishing to migrate there and start a farm. On his arrival, however, he discovered there was no record of the land he thought he had purchased. He had been the victim of a fraud. He was thus forced to become a tenant farmer, growing peaches and some potatoes, but had not been very successful with either. Now, he said, he had started to grow vegetables. From each of the members' stories, Shinichi could keenly sense the hardships they had undergone since arriving in Brazil. The first Japanese contract emigrants had moved to Brazil in 1908. On April 28 of that year, the ship Kasato Maru left the port of Kobe with 781 passengers on board and arrived in the Brazilian port of Santos on June 18 after 52 days at sea. Brazil had abolished slavery in 1888. However, as if to compensate, immigrants were often treated little better than slaves. Many countries in Europe, seriously concerned about the virulence of yellow fever and malaria in Brazil, were curtailing emigration of their citizens to the South American country. With fewer immigrants, the owners of coffee plantations in Sao Paulo were left severely short-handed. They sought new cheap labor to do the work that slaves had formerly done. Many coffee plantation owners would not even afford to pay regular wages to their workers due to the falling coffee prices in the international market, which began in 1897. It was against this backdrop that an ambassadorial minister from Japan visited Brazil. He received a lavish welcome and later reported to the Japanese government that the country was a fertile paradise bequeathed by the heavens. Shortly thereafter, Japanese emigration to Brazil began. A recruitment notice described the conditions awaiting would-be emigrants as follows. The land around Sao Paulo is extremely fertile. Crops such as coffee, sugar, cotton, and rice can be grown without using any fertilizer. The climate closely resembles that of southern Europe, and, irrespective of race, all people are guaranteed full and equal rights. The language of the notice seemed specifically designed to give people the impression that Brazil was a present-day utopia. Moreover, the usual Chinese characters that had been used to transliterate the word Brazil into Japanese in the past were replaced with a new set of characters, the individual meaning of which conjured up vivid images of an exotic paradise. At the time, Japan was in the throes of a serious recession following the Russo-Japanese War, and not a few of its citizens sought to find a better life by migrating to another country. In addition, anti-Japanese exclusionist sentiment had begun to surface in the United States, the country that had until then been the main destination for Japanese emigrants. This prompted the Japanese government to discontinue emigration to the United States. As a result, people's attention focused on Brazil as a promising new land. No doubt these emigrants dreamed of Brazil, embellished with such effusive words of praise as an earthly paradise. They travelled there with hope in their hearts and filled with visions of making their fortunes and bringing glory and prestige to their hometowns in Japan. Brazil remained the principal destination for Japanese immigrants until 1932, when Japan began its campaign to recruit settlers for Manchuria and Mongolia. Someone once observed that it may be the eternal paradox of human beings to show great cleverness when they deceive and great foolishness when they are deceived. Cherishing dreams for the future, Japanese immigrants flocked to Brazilian coffee plantations. But all that awaited them was a wretched existence, a far cry from the paradise they envisioned. They were called colono, that is settlers, by the locals, and work on the land was unimaginably hard. They had to build their own homes, even their own beds. There was no running water, electricity, or toilets. They were also plagued by sand flies that burrowed under people's nails and caused painful, oozing infections that itched unbearably. On many farms, the immigrants were treated like slaves, spurred on by the cracking of whips. In some places, they were not even called by their own names but referred to by numbers. Many immigrants fled under the cover of night, but to do so was to condemn themselves to the life of a wandering peasant. At some point, the following song had become popular among the Japanese immigrants. Who was it that said, "Brazil's a great place. Duped by the emigration company, we travelled halfway around the world, only to find the paradise we'd heard of was in fact hell. My, oh my." Some refer to themselves not as immigrants, but vagrants. Gradually, however, a few Japanese immigrants did manage to work their way up, toiling in earnest silence under extremely harsh circumstances, advancing from employed labourer to contract labourer, and eventually becoming independent farmers who owned their own land. Later, too, some of them would establish businesses that came to be known as colonia. However, the winds of destiny were incredibly cold and harsh. In 1930, a military coup d'etat gave birth to the Vargas regime, which promoted a series of nationalistic policies that spurred a growing tide of anti-Japanese sentiment. This led to the enactment of legislation restricting Japanese immigration, the banning of foreign language publications, and prohibiting schools from teaching their curricula in languages other than Portuguese, Brazil's national language. The year after the outbreak of the Pacific War in 1941, Brazil severed diplomatic ties with Japan. In June 1945, it declared war on Japan. This only exacerbated the hardship suffered by those of Japanese descent living in Brazil. Gatherings of more than 3 persons of Japanese ancestry were banned, individual assets were frozen, and many were driven from the land they had worked so hard to cultivate. Later, Japan's surrender would also unleash unexpected confusion among Brazil's Japanese community. Turning into a crackling and indistinct broadcast from Japan on their shortwave radios, many Japanese Brazilians heard the news of Japan's defeat. Having been taught that not a single soldier of the Imperial Army must ever surrender, however, many of them just could not believe, or more precisely, did not want to believe, that the Japanese Emperor, the Generalissimo of the Army and Navy, had capitulated to the enemy. Rumors thus began to circulate in Brazil that Japan had won the war. Left largely uninformed about news and events in society following the Brazilian government's ban on the publication of Japanese language newspapers, many Japanese Brazilians avidly seized on this rumor. Others who did believe the news of Japan's defeat launched a movement to make their fellow Japanese Brazilians recognize the truth. The Japanese Brazilian community split into two opposing camps: those who believed Japan to be victorious and those who acknowledged Japan's defeat. Thus, one Japanese Brazilian was pitted against another. The victory camp was led by an ultra-nationalistic group called the Shindo Alliance. Individuals associated with this alliance formed a special commando unit, which instigated a succession of terrorist attacks against the leaders of the defeat camp. This prompted the victimized group to lodge an appeal with the Brazilian president to halt the terrorism perpetuated by the victory group, which it denounced as spreading poison in Brazilian society. Although these efforts paid off with a full-scale crackdown on the activities of the Shindo Alliance, it had the unfortunate effect of adding further fuel to the country's exclusionist sentiment towards all Japanese Brazilians. The false rumors circulated by the Victory Group immediately after the war, even going so far as to proclaim that the United States had unconditionally surrendered to Japan, plunged the Japanese Brazilian community into deep confusion. This escalated into talk of a Japanese military occupation of Brazil and the total repatriation of all Japanese citizens in Brazil. These unfounded rumors also spawned numerous incidents of malicious fraud. The most noted of these was the so-called yen-selling incident. Hearing the news that all Japanese citizens were preparing to leave the country en masse, many Japanese in Brazil sold off their homes and land and practically vied with one another to change their money into yen. By seeming coincidence, there happened to be a large volume of Japanese yen available to be sold. After the war, however, Japan had issued new currency. The notes that were circulating in Brazil around this time were thus obsolete and nothing more than useless scraps of paper. Day after day, endless lines of people, their pockets filled with worthless bills, could be seen standing at the docks, waiting in vain for the ships they thought would take them back to Japan. When it finally came to light that they had been swindled, some people took their own lives. This was a truly despicable case of fraud in which unscrupulous Japanese Brazilians took advantage of the confusion of the times to prey on their compatriots. The antagonism among Japanese Brazilians, who had divided themselves into victory and defeat camps, continued for several years after the war. It was only when this conflict had abated that Brazil formally reopened its doors to Japan immigration in February 1953. Some 7.5 years after Japan's surrender. Compared to the situation before the war, a much more favorable environment awaited post-war Japanese immigrants to Brazil. Would-be immigrants were subjected to a strict screening procedure. There were far fewer Japanese wishing to move to Brazil temporarily to earn money and then return to Japan. Now, many Japanese sought to settle there permanently, and this was not just to engage in agriculture. As more and more Japanese enterprises began venturing into Brazil, an increasing number of technicians joined the ranks of immigrants. Japanese Brazilians came to be active in all spheres of Brazilian society, gradually winning for themselves a deepening trust and respect among the population as a whole. Nevertheless, living in a foreign country entailed many hardships. Depending on where the newcomers settled, discord sometimes arose between them and Japanese Brazilians who had immigrated before the war. As he spoke with the local members who had come to the Gongyo meeting, Shinichi Yamamoto gained a clear picture of each person's occupation, condition of faith, and even his or her personality and character. Almost all the members had started practicing the Daishonin's Buddhism in Japan within the last 4 or 5 years. Quite a few had striven within the organization in such frontline leadership positions as unit chief. While taking the lead in activities for Kosen Rufu in their respective regions, they had spoken to friends and acquaintances about the Daishonin's Buddhism. As a result of their efforts, one or two people in each area had begun to join them in chanting Daimoku. Discussion meetings were also now being held regularly in Sao Paulo. Tiny buds of Kosen Rufu were beginning to sprout in the country of Brazil. It was at this time that the members received news that the newly inaugurated third president of the Soka Gakkai, Shinichi Yamamoto, would be visiting Brazil with several other top leaders. Those local members who had been playing a leading role in activities literally danced for joy when they heard this. They threw themselves wholeheartedly into preparations for the group's arrival. Since they would be welcoming the Soka Gakkai president, they made elaborate plans to bring all the members in Sao Paulo together for the occasion. Knowing that there must still be some members who had not been contacted, the local members came up with the ingenious idea of placing an announcement of the Soka Gakkai president visit in the Japanese language newspapers. This proved even more effective than they had hoped and led to contact with a host of hitherto unknown members. Filled with joy and excitement, the members waited impatiently for Shinichi and his party to arrive. After hearing the members' reports, Shinichi said, smiling brightly, "The dawn of Kōsan Rūfu in Brazil is now approaching. I have come to Brazil with the intention of establishing the first chapter outside of Japan." There were gasps and cries of surprise from among the participants. Shinichi continued, "This means that Brazil will assume the mission of a pioneer of worldwide Kōsan Rūfu. Each of you is a pioneer. Opening new frontiers naturally entails great trial and hardship. But if you succeed in surmounting these obstacles, a paradise of happiness will unfold for you here in Brazil. Together, let's blaze the trail of Kōsan Rūfu for the sake of this country and the prosperity of all your families." After their evening meal, Shinichi and the other leaders met to discuss the formation of the new chapter. They deliberated carefully over where to establish districts and who to appoint to leadership positions, taking into account the number of members who lived scattered throughout each region. It was past midnight when Shinichi returned to his room. Although he was so physically exhausted that he felt dizzy, he reached into his bag for some writing paper. He then sat down at the table and began to write a letter of encouragement to a fellow member in Japan. Indeed, he wrote several such letters. Despite his extreme physical weakness, Shinichi's heart beat vibrantly, filled with delight at being here in Brazil, breaking new ground for the development of Kōsan Rūfu in place of his beloved mentor, Josei Toda. This joy and fighting spirit became a passionate cry for Kōsan Rūfu that filled his entire being and caused his pen to fly across page after page. To one chapter leader, he wrote, "Right now, my sole thought is to carry on President Toda's intent and dedicate myself to completing the foundation for Kōsan Rūfu, even if it costs me my life. People are vital to this endeavor, people of outstanding ability. I fervently hope that you will always join me in this task and courageously walk the path of your mission to the very end. And on my behalf, I hope you will love every member of your chapter with all your heart and guide them all towards happiness." The members in Japan had no idea of the circumstances under which he wrote these letters. Later, however, when they learned of the ill health that had plagued him during his overseas journey, tears welled in their eyes as they fiercely renewed their vow to struggle alongside him for Kōsan Rūfu. It is only sincere actions that have the power to move people's hearts. A discussion meeting was held on October 20th, the following day. The venue was the second floor of a restaurant called Cha Flora, which was located in a primarily Asian section of Sao Paulo. Japanese Brazilians often used the place to hold gatherings and events. Although the discussion meeting was not scheduled to begin until 1 p.m., members started filtering in before noon. Every face was bright and cheerful. Some members had come from regions as far as 1,500 kilometers away. Traveling on a succession of trains and buses, it had taken them 3 full days and nights to reach Sao Paulo. By 12:30, all of the several dozen or so seats in the room were filled and people began to stand in the back. When Shinichi Yamamoto and the other leaders arrived, there was a spontaneous burst of applause. Many who attended had tenaciously kept the flame of their faith alive while struggling all alone in regions far from the city, without other members to depend on. "President Yamamoto has come all this way to see us. Our president has come to Brazil." When they thought of this, they could not hold back their tears. One woman murmured, "I can't see President Toda anyway. I wonder if he'll be coming later." The woman sitting next to her whispered back, "Haven't you heard? President Toda passed away. Mr. Yamamoto has become the third president." Communication in Brazil in those days was poor. Mail from Japan sometimes took 3 months to reach an address in Sao Paulo. It was not rare for mail addressed to more remote areas never to reach its destination. Given this situation, it was not strange that some members, having no contact with others in the organization, had remained unaware of Toda's death. Standing before the gathering, Shinichi bowed and sat down at the long, narrow table in the front of the room. "Thank you all for coming today. Let's begin, shall we?" At this meeting, Shinichi devoted even more time to answering the members' questions. He was well aware of how hard life was for the immigrant farmers. He wanted to offer appropriate guidance and encouragement to those who were desperately struggling to find a way out of their difficulties without leaders in faith to guide them or anyone with whom they could discuss their problems. "Please feel free to ask me anything you like. That's why I have come," said Shinichi. 4 or 5 hands immediately shot up. Everyone had been longing for such an opportunity. Many of the questions were about serious issues related to the members' very survival. One man in his early 40s began speaking nervously. "Occupation, farmer," he introduced himself, his tone resembling that of a soldier reporting his rank. "Please relax," said Shinichi. "This isn't the army. We're all friends, all a family. Just relax as you would in your own home." The members laughed. A bright smile also lit the man's sunburnt face. He then explained that he had recently started to farm vegetables, but his crop had failed. As a result, he was now heavily in debt. He wanted to know what he could do to overcome this situation. "What was the reason for your crop failure?" Shinichi asked. "I think it might have been partly due to the weather," the man replied. "Are there other farmers growing the same vegetables as you who produced a successful crop?" "Yes, but most people's crops failed." "Was there some problem with the fertilizer you used?" "I'm not sure." "Was there a problem with the way you tended your crop?" Silence. "What about the relationship between the soil and the vegetable you're trying to grow in it?" "I don't know." The man could not reply satisfactorily to any of Shinichi's questions. As a farmer, he had clearly been working hard and trying to do the best he could. But so was everyone else. He was unaware of his own complacence in thinking that what he had been doing was enough. Shinichi began speaking in a penetrating tone. "First of all, it is vital that you thoroughly investigate the cause that led to your crop failure so that you don't make the same mistake again. You might want to talk with farmers who have been successful and take note of what they have to say. It's also important that you take sufficient measures to prevent failure. People who are deadly serious about what they are doing are always studying and exerting their ingenuity to solve problems. You will not be successful if you neglect such things. You will be greatly mistaken if you think that just because you practice faith, your fields alone will yield abundant crops without any effort on your part. Buddhism is a teaching of unsurpassed reason. Therefore, the strength of one's faith must manifest itself in the form of study, exercising your ingenuity, and making twice as much effort as anyone else. Earnest daimoku is the wellspring for the energy to challenge these things. Your daimoku must also be a pledge." "A pledge?" asked the man. None of the members had ever heard of such a concept before. "Yes, a pledge," Shinichi emphasized. "This means to make a vow of your own accord and pray to fulfill it. Of course, there are many ways of praying. Some people may pray that everything just falls into their laps without having to make any effort. But a religion that encourages such prayer is one that will lead people to ruin. Prayer in Nichiren Daishonin's Buddhism means to chant Daimoku based on a pledge or vow. At its very core, this vow is to attain Kosenrufu. It means chanting resolutely with the determination, I will realize Kosenrufu in Brazil. Therefore, I will show magnificent actual proof in my work. Please enable me somehow to bring forth my greatest potential. This is what our prayer should be like. It is also important that we establish clear and concrete goals for what we hope to achieve each day, and then pray and challenge ourselves to achieve each of them. This earnest determination gives rise to wisdom and resourcefulness, thereby leading to success. In short, to win in life, we need determination and prayer, effort and ingenuity. It is misguided to dream of getting rich quick, expecting to encounter a rare stroke of luck or some shrewd money-making scheme. This is not faith, it is mere fantasy. Our work is the mainstay that supports our lives. Unless we show real evidence of victory in our work, we cannot demonstrate the principle that faith manifests itself in daily life. Please rid yourself of any laxness and reapply yourself wholeheartedly to your work with a fresh determination. I'll do my best, said the man, his eyes filled with resolve. Shinichi was well aware of the hardships these immigrant farmers were facing. To be successful under such circumstances, they would above all have to battle their own complacency. The enemy they had to face was within. The greater the adversity, the more important it is to resolve that now is the time to achieve a victory in life and to keep challenging oneself. It is here that the beneficial power of the Gohonzon becomes manifest. Adversity is therefore an opportunity to prove the power of Buddhism. Towards the end of the question and answer session, Shinichi noticed a woman in the back row who had been hesitantly raising her hand and putting it down again throughout the session. Somewhere in her mid-30s, her face was gaunt and tired-looking. You have a question, don't you? Please go ahead, he encouraged her. She stood up listlessly and said, you see, my husband died from illness. I just don't know how I'm going to survive from now on. The woman had immigrated with her husband and children under a contract labor agreement and had been working the land. Deprived of her husband's crucial participation, however, it was impossible to continue the work of farming alone. She also still had several small children to look after. Just as she was entertaining thoughts of suicide, she heard about the Daishonin's Buddhism from a Soka Gakkai member living nearby. She had started her practice just 1 week prior to the meeting. In that short space of time, she found employment at a factory in Sao Paulo, which also provided her lodging. But, she continued, when I think of living here in a foreign country I know nothing about, struggling to provide for my children, I can't help feeling anxious. I think I must have awfully deep karma, and I have no idea what else may happen in the future. Just thinking about it is unbearable. Shinichi smiled at her and said, please don't worry. As long as you're practicing this faith, you can definitely become happy. That's what Buddhism is for. Also, your current suffering and misfortune exists so that you may fulfill your own unique and noble mission. Everything will turn to defeat if all you do is worry about your karma and let it make you miserable. The woman gazed at Shinichi with a look of puzzlement. The member who had introduced her to the practice had told her that the reason she had to suffer the loss of her husband was because of negative karma she had accumulated from offences committed in past lifetimes. It is true that Buddhism teaches that one who commits evil deeds against others will receive the negative effects of those actions and live an unhappy life. This is just one aspect, however. Were it the entire teaching on karma, then people would be doomed to live under a cloud of guilt and vague anxiety, not knowing what offences they might have committed in past lives. It would also mean that the people's destiny was fixed, a concept that could easily rob them of their energy and passion. It might also cause people to lapse into a passive way of life, simply concerning themselves with not doing anything bad. The Buddhism of Nichiren Daishonin goes far beyond the framework of superficial causality. It elucidates the most fundamental cause and shows us the means for returning to the pure life within that has existed since time without beginning. This fundamental cause is to awaken to our mission as bodhisattvas of the earth and dedicate our lives to the widespread propagation of the law. Shinichi said, Buddhism teaches that its practitioners voluntarily chose to be born in evil circumstances so they may help others. This means that although we have accumulated the benefit through Buddhist practice to be born in favorable circumstances, we have purposely chosen to be born in the midst of suffering people and there propagate the mystic law. I will stop there with our reading today. I hope you have a good day.